From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, dating and shopping in the 1990s when you've reached your 40s. We talk to feminist humorist Cynthia Heimel. She dispenses tongue-in-cheek advice in both The Village Voice and Playboy. Also today, we talk with singer Thomas Mafumo of Zimbabwe. His liberation music landed him in jail during the fight against the white rule government in what was then Rhodesia. And book critic John Leonard reviews Gloria Emerson's account of life on the Gaza Strip. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An amendment backed by the National Rifle Association designed to block a vote on the so-called Brady Bill failed today by 234 to 193. It was a major defeat for the gun lobby. The House is now voting on the Brady Bill, which would require a national 7-day waiting period for the purchase of handguns. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In a surprise vote, members of the House voted down the NRA-backed amendment that would have set up a nationwide instant computer check system. Backers of the amendment said the Brady Bill waiting period would be ineffective and would place a burden on gun owners. Pat Williams is a Democrat from Montana.
Crime is rampant, and we now have 20,000 gun control laws and regulations on the books in America. Gun control, gun registration has not work.
The vote was considered too close to call. It was a surprise that it failed by 30 votes. Now the waiting period supporters hope to pass the Brady Bill by a similar margin. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Bush announced today that William Webster is retiring as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Webster was named to head the CIA in 1987, replacing Iran-Contra figure William Casey. Webster, who's 67, came to the post after service as a federal judge and 9 years as head of the FBI. President Bush, who's also a former CIA director, didn't name a successor to Webster. Among those who've been named as possible candidates for the post is longtime CIA official Robert Gates. President Bush reacted again today to the allegations that the Reagan-Bush campaign entered into a deal with the Iranians to delay the release of 52 American hostages until after the 1980 election, thereby hurting Jimmy Carter's chances to remain in the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The allegations are old and they haven't been proved, but the story persists and it has clearly upset the president. Today, he responded to the charges that he met with Iranians in 1980 in Paris to talk about a deal, calling the allegations ugly rumors and bald-faced lies. Bush's spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, has offered to release the president's daily schedule from 1980 to show that he was not overseas during the time the deal was allegedly discussed. Also today, the former president of Iran, Abolhassan Banisadr, met with 10 members of the House of Representatives. Republicans emerged from the meeting on Capitol Hill, saying Banisadr's claims that the Reagan-Bush campaign had made a deal with Iran were based on hearsay. But a Democratic congressman said that members should continue to evaluate any new information and evidence. House Democrats are currently considering whether or not to begin an investigation into the charges. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points today to close at 2,930.9. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Rescue and cleanup efforts in Bangladesh have been hampered by new natural disasters. The death toll from yesterday's tornado in the country's industrial region is now at least 40. More than 400 people were hurt and 2,500 homes destroyed. At the same time, heavy rains caused flash floods in the northeastern part of the country. Damage from the latest disasters is making it difficult to distribute food, fresh water, and medicine to the survivors of last week's cyclone. Relief workers have warned that the survivors may face starvation and disease if they're not helped soon. One of the nation's most troubled cities, East St. Louis in Illinois, got a new mayor today. Kathy Lohr has this report.
Gordon Bush was sworn in as mayor of this community of 40,000 right across the river from St. Louis, Missouri. East St. Louis is at least $50 million in debt and owes another $22 million to the Internal Revenue Service. Three-fourths of the city's residents received some type of public assistance. Despite the overwhelming obstacles, newly elected Mayor Bush calls it a time of hope for East St. Louis.
That we can do something about East St. Louis. That we can pull together that East St. Louis. That we can make East St. Louis a town that can stand and one that we can be proud of.
Mayor Bush has promised to clean up trash problems, improve police and fire service, and meet the city's payroll, which is about 2 weeks behind schedule. He says he'll also try to win back City Hall, which was given away as part of a judgment in a lawsuit against the city. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Lohr reporting.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney continued his trip through the Middle East today, talking to leaders about post-war security arrangements in the Persian Gulf. Cheney delivered letters from President Bush to leaders in the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman, and Bahrain today. He also outlined the latest administration thinking on a continuing U.S. presence in the region. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I can think of only one feminist humorist who writes tongue-in-cheek advice columns on fashion and boyfriends, and that's my guest, Cynthia Heimel. She may be a humorist, but her observations about love in a hideously complicated world are more perceptive than you're apt to find in a real self-help book. She writes for The Village Voice and Playboy. Her subjects over the years have included Zen in the Art of Diaphragm Insertion, Sex and the Single Parent, The Great Boyfriend Crunch, and Why She Hates Couples. She has a new collection of pieces called If You Can't Live Without Me, Why Aren't You Dead Yet? Here's an excerpt from her piece Snow Job. If you're single, you'll recognize the dilemma. Someone asks you out for dinner, but how can you tell if it's a real date?
From now on, I think we must have new social behavior. From now on, we have to know whether we're going on a real date or not. I can't take it anymore. I can't take getting any more phone calls from any more men saying, how about if we go on a date on Saturday night? And what they really mean is, how about if we go to a party uptown and meet a lot of our friends and then all go out for something to eat and then I go home with someone else? Or, how about if I take you to this odd little neighborhood place and tell you all about my divorce and how I have no sex drive anymore and how I don't think I'll ever be involved with anyone ever again and then ask you for advice on how to pick up the barmaid? Or, how about if we go to a nightclub where I pump you for information about jobs, then I come right out and ask you to help me get a job, then I put a lampshade on my head, then in the taxi home I get out real quick and you pick up the fare? I mean, it's humiliating as hell to get a call for a date and not even know whether to be nervous or not. To not even be able to take that initial step and ask yourself whether you like this guy, whether you're attracted to this guy, whether you ever want to see this guy without his clothes on, because he may not even mean it. He may want to be just friends. But he doesn't tell me that, no. People are modern now. So I have to do this hideous mental contortion of keeping my mind totally blank, expecting nothing, hoping for nothing, but meanwhile I have to clean my house, wash my hair, shave my legs, rub in body oil, splash on perfume, find stockings, try on 10 outfits, jump on the scale a few times, blow dry my hair, wet it and blow dry it all over again, reapply deodorant, brush my teeth for 15 minutes, then put my hair in a ponytail, just in case. All the while I try keeping my mind a blank, all the while my mind refuses to be a blank in Keynes. Is this a date or not?
That's great. When did this start becoming a problem?
I noticed it about 3 or 4 years ago that suddenly people were phoning up and asking me out on specious, weird dates. And I almost wanted to start out dinner and say, okay, what are your intentions? But I've never had the nerve to do that.
Why not? You're a pretty nervy person.
Nervy in my writing, watch me in real life. A whole different kettle of nerves.
Do you ever ask men out?
Yeah, absolutely. And still, I don't know if they know that it's a date. And I don't know how to say, I'm asking you out because I think I might want to sleep with you. I mean, what do you say? How do you do it? I guess I have to figure this out because nobody else is doing it. I guess it's my job.
Well, you know, as women, like we were brought up where a man or a boy asks a woman or a girl out for a date,
right.
And if there's any kind of, you know, romantic sexual contact, the male initiates it. So you had to overcome, you know, that kind of
socialization and training. Have you ever, like, also, like, initiated the first romantic contact? Have you gotten to that point?
Never. I mean, it's like involuntary, you know, you breathe without thinking about it. I think I've been trained from the time I was 6 months old to be passive when it comes to that sort of thing. It would take more than courage. It would take being blind, roaring drunk, which I, you know, I don't think I would ever be able to do it. Certainly after I've had sex with someone, I can initiate it, but not if there's never been any contact. It's just too scary. I mean, it's like that T.S. Eliot poem, you're just afraid they're going to suddenly say, that's not what I meant at all. That's not it at all. You know, I'm just too timid.
Do you ever feel, though, that, you know, as a feminist, you should get over this thing and be able to, you know, be on equal terms even in starting a romantic relationship? You know, do you feel like you're behind on that level and you should try to overcome that? Or do you just accept that that's the way you are?
I don't know. I used to spend hours and weeks and months working on myself to make myself more attractive, more available, more wonderful, more thinner, with more hair, with better skin, just so I could attract men. And as I've gotten more self-confident, less insane, I think I'm tired of turning myself inside out. If somebody wants to go out with me, they'll let me know. I'll let them know back, but I don't feel like pursuing it to the ends of the earth anymore. It's just too demeaning. I think women's roles have been to feel that we're doing something wrong if we're not dating. We're doing something wrong if nobody's asking us out. There's something hideously awful, a secret thing about us that everyone can see but ourselves. And we read like 100 million self-help books, you know. Women Who Love Too Much was actually probably not a bad book. But to have half the female population devouring this book and then realizing, yes, I have something new wrong with me. I think that's anti-feminist. I think it's about time we all just said, okay, you want me, fine. If you don't want me, too bad.
Now, you're one of the few feminists I can think of who writes about fashion and dating. And granted, you do this with a lot of irony, but on the other hand, like, you really do love shoes a lot.
You should see the shoes I'm wearing right now. Here, have a look. Well, I think that they're, not only do I find them fun, but I find them fascinating. I think you can tell so much about a person by the way she or he dresses. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, people are wearing sandwich boards telling you all about what their socioeconomic aspirations are. That's hard to say. What they want in bed, what they think of themselves, what they want you to think of them by the way they're dressed. And it's all, you know, in New York especially, the cut of your jacket defines your sort of place in the social hierarchy.
What makes you angry when you go shopping for clothes now? What do you find frustrating?
Well, the prices are, of course, frustrating for anyone who wants to look good. The other thing that I think is really frustrating is that there are so many of us now who are approaching or have reached 40 and do not want to become grandmothers, do not want to become dowdy, do not want to become frumps, do not want to look desperately like mutton dressed as lamb. And all we're confronted with are clothes for teenagers. Now, I love Betsy Johnson to death, and I've always worn Betsy Johnson clothes, but I can't really wear them anymore. I can't wear a lot of them anymore. I don't want to wear a baby doll dress covered with flowers, pink baby doll dress. I would just look stupid. So what I want to know is, who's out there designing weird, fashionable, adventuresome clothes for women of my age and the thousands and millions of women who, you know, there's so many of us who grew up in the 60s, who just don't want to suddenly settle into the stereotypical world of Chanel suits or faux Chanel suits.
As a feminist writing sometimes about clothes, how do you feel like your take is different than, I mean, I think this should be pretty obvious from what you're saying, but anyways, if I could get you to elaborate on it.
Well, I think the problem is that the feminist label has gotten such a rotten name lately, don't you think? It's almost like the minute Andrea Dworkin reared her ugly head, and I think she's interesting, but she's really extremely, extremely radical and sort of, I don't know, I think she's of the lunatic fringe of feminism. But as soon as she was out there, the media was just so relieved that they could hop on feminists like Andrea Dworkin and say, see, this is what they're like. They're a danger. They're a menace, these feminists. Look at them. They say all penetration is rape. They say all men should be killed. In fact, I think a feminist is allowed to like clothes. A feminist is allowed to like shoes. A feminist is allowed to like and love men. It's just that the perception these days is that you have to be wearing combat boots and camouflage clothing and have your hair cut to 1/4 inch from your scalp and be carrying an Uzi in your purse if you're a feminist. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to think that Andrea Dworkin hasn't cornered the market on the word feminist, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Now, I work at Playboy, as you know, which is, I'm their token feminist. Whenever anybody attacks Playboy magazine, they trot me out. What do you mean? What do you mean we're anti-women? Look, we have Cynthia Heimel yelling at men every month, or every other month now. And they just loved to just, they had feature upon feature about Andrea Dworkin for a while. I think she's news, and I think that's why I'm not sure that there was any malice aforethought, but it sure didn't work out well for us women with long, curly hair and skirts on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is humorist Cynthia Heimel. She writes tongue-in-cheek advice columns, among other things. She writes for The Village Voice and Playboy, and she has a new collection, which is called If You Can't Live Without Me, Why Aren't You Dead Yet? More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Humorist Cynthia Heimel is my guest. I want to get back to the reading that you did a little earlier.
Okay.
Are you single now or in a couple?
I'm single. I've been single for 4 years, and I'm starting to freeze up. I don't know. It's been so long, I can't imagine being with anyone. 4 years to me is a long time.
Well, you've been going out with people in between?
Every once in a while I go out with people.
So, like, do you worry about things will I grow old alone and things like that? Is that the kind of thing that worries you?
Well, not really. I think it worried me more in my late 20s and early 30s than it worries me now. Because after having been alone for a while, I realized that the fear of being alone is really much worse than being alone. I'm not lonely. I have a very close family, which is all my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I see people in relationships being tortured because they're in the wrong relationships. And it's not that I wouldn't like to be with someone. Of course I would. Or maybe not of course, but I would. I just don't feel that kind of urgency. I don't. And I'm lucky. I'm really happy. I don't know if it's, you know, from going to a shrink for 17 years or that's a joke, but for a long time, or just getting more mature or whatever. But for me, and I think it can be true for anybody, after a while you realize that it's just this sort of society-induced hysteria. Plus, I am really sick of every single person in the world getting married and having children right now. I think it's kind of a dreadful fad. Whatever happened to choice? Whatever happened to the idea of maybe I'll have children, but you don't want to? There's so much pressure now for people to have children.
Yeah, what do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's because the world's so scary and everybody's sort of escaping back to the most cozy kind of life they can. I think having children is the greatest. I have a child, as I guess you know that. Of course you know that.
Yeah, well, he's grown up.
He just turned 21 last week. I'm very proud of myself. I feel like I raised a great kid. But I think probably the kids that people are having now will be better off than we were because the parents are a lot more enlightened. The only problem is they're so damned enlightened that they're putting their kids on a pedestal. And I just wonder how how that's going to affect them. They get so much attention. They get so much love and money lavished on them. And they're almost like this sort of the newest, latest accessory, you know, so that, that all the money is spent and all the time is spent. And there's flashcards and there's private schools. And the kids are pressured, I think, to be as wonderful as possible all the time. I hope they're okay. I think they'll be better than, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child people. But it's still going to be weird.
I want to change the subject a little bit. In one of your pieces in your new book, there's a piece about inviting over a few male friends and then another piece about inviting over a few female friends to watch pornography. What was this exercise about? Were you trying to compare the differences between men and women and their reaction to pornographic films?
Well, they were Playboy columns, so I'm not sure that I consciously knew what I was doing, but it was an experiment. Yeah, it was to see what men were like. And then when I realized that they acted so completely goofy, I thought, well, let's see what women do. And, you know, it was so amazing. I think that biologically, the males and females are so differently organized. You know, they just, I'm surprised we ever get together at all. Because men are so visual, and women have to have so many fantasies or have to be somehow attached or in love to really be having sex.
Were the women kind of baffled about what men were doing to women in the movie? I mean, sometimes I think that pornographic films are made by people who have no idea how women function.
Yeah, well, the women said, you know, they were just laughing. I mean, it was so absurd. There was one scene in one of the movies where the woman was having phone sex with the guy, and she was wearing God knows, you know, like one of those garter belts, and her hair was perfect and her makeup was perfect, and she was sort of breathing heavily over the phone. And the few women in the room who had talked sexy to their boyfriends over the phone, you know, had some version of phone sex, we were all saying, oh, sure, we were wearing flannel nightgowns and knee socks and, you know, get out of here. Who does that? No one. No one does that. No one is like that. It's, you know, wet dream time. And that's what those movies are for. They're not for us. They're not for women. I saw some that were designed for women, and they did do a lot of good draperies, and they did a lot of good, you know, interior design, but they were so boring and bad. I think that the most pornographic film for a woman is like A Room with a View. You know, where it's just seething under the surface. I can't wait, I can't wait, oh my God, you know, that kind of thing.
I want to ask you about the tone that you use in your writing. Because you have this great, funny, ironic tone, whether you're talking about sex or clothes or self-help books or whatever. And it seems like, you know, like part Dorothy Parker, part spoof of fashion magazine. Talk to me about your tone a little bit in your writing, where it comes from, what you're doing with it.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to have a style and it just evolved. I think I never went to college, so nobody ever taught me how to write, which helps a lot because they can teach you all the wrong things in college if you try and take a creative writing course from a moron. And I read all the time when I was a kid. And I remember when I was like 16 reading J.D. Salinger incessantly. So I think there's something like J.D. Salinger in there. It's changed, but that's how it started. I read a lot of Hunter Thompson and Tom Wolfe for journalism. And I just worship these people. But I don't really, you know, to me, it's the only way to write. It makes sense to me. It's sometimes really interesting when I see somebody who's copying me, and that happens to me every once in a while, and I kind of recognize the style. And it's awesome. It's so interesting to see that somebody's copying me because it makes me realize I do have a style.
You write, among other places, for The Village Voice and for Playboy, and it would be hard, I think, to find two publications that represent different politics. So what do you...
How about when I worked for The Village Voice, Vogue, and Playboy?
Oh, okay, great.
How about a spectrum there? Yeah.
So how are you treated differently? What do you represent at each of those publications?
At The Village Voice, I'm definitely the comic relief. I mean, it's a very earnest paper, and everyone is extremely socially aware and socially active and politically aware and politically active. And I'm much lighter at the Village Voice because I don't feel I have to preach to anybody. It would be like preaching to the converted. The audience of the Village Voice is people who already are AIDS activists or black activists or feminist activists or wannabes anyway. And so I can just go as goofy as I want, and I do. Whereas in Playboy, I feel that I have to, that I have an audience of fairly conservative men, not always. I mean, it's an interesting magazine because they do have decent, you know, fiction and journalism. They have really well-done pieces. They have actually nice editors there. But they still mainly have naked women. So a lot of men are going to buy it just to look at the naked women. And I have to address those men and say, okay, this is what women are like. Besides what you see on page 142, this is what we're thinking about. This is what it's like to go to the gynecologist. This is how we feel about our careers. So my friend Emily Prager once called being in Penthouse being in the missionary position, and I thought that was a really good way to put it. Okay, guys, listen to this. And Playboy is, the thing I really like about it is they are extremely left-wing and liberal when it comes to anything else besides naked women. And they'll let me write anything I want. They do not censor me because they think I'm being too mean or too far out or because I use words they don't like. They might try and stop me from putting in a column that's boring, but I can't blame them for that.
I've got one last question for you. Do you feel that you're getting braver in any way as you get older, and is there something that you're planning to do that you've never done before, but now you feel you have the guts to try it?
Yeah. Yeah, I am getting kind of braver. It's like, okay, you've brought up your kid. You don't have to worry about him anymore. Maybe you could write a novel now. So that's about it, though.
That's how you're trying your novel?
I'm thinking of starting it. It's just a notion. But maybe soon it'll be an idea, and then it'll be a concept.
Well, good. I wish you good luck with it.
Thank you.
Cynthia Heimel, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
And Cynthia Heimel's new book is called If You Can't Live Without Me, Why Aren't You Dead Yet? This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the singer they call the Lion of Zimbabwe. Thomas Mafumo is perhaps the most popular singer in his country and one of the most popular figures now in world music. In the 70s, his liberation songs helped propel the uprising against the white rule government. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Gaza, journalist Gloria Emerson's account of the year she spent as an eyewitness to the Intifada. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The House has approved by a vote of 239 to 186 the Brady Bill, which calls for a 7-day waiting period in order to buy handguns. Earlier this evening, gun control advocates won a victory when the House turned down a competing plan called the Staggers Amendment, which had been supported by the National Rifle Association. In 1988, the Brady Bill was defeated by 46 votes. Since then, advocates have worked hard to build up support for the measure. The Brady Bill is named for former Reagan Press Secretary James Brady, who was left paralyzed after the 1981 attempt on the life of President Reagan. The bill still faces a tough road in the Senate. William Webster has announced that he's stepping down as head of the CIA. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
On Capitol Hill today, Webster was praised as a man who literally saved both the FBI and the CIA by restoring public confidence in each agency at a time when it was racked by scandal. President Reagan plucked Webster from the FBI in 1987 when the Iran-Contra scandal broke and threatened to engulf the CIA. And when President Bush was elected, Webster stayed on despite persistent rumors that Mr. Bush wanted his own man at CIA. Today, Mr. Bush announced Webster's retirement, heaping praise on the director and adding, "I'll miss you, pal." In an interview with NPR, Webster said he began contemplating a move after passing the anniversary of his fourth year at the CIA and his 26th year in government, years during which he served as a prosecutor, a judge, and as FBI and CIA directors. As to who will succeed Webster at CIA, the names mentioned most frequently are two former CIA officials, both close friends of the president, Deputy National Security Advisor Robert Gates, and James Lilly, who is just wrapping up a stint as ambassador to China. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Yugoslavia, a deadlocked federal leadership met again in emergency session in another effort to put an end to ethnic violence in Croatia. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports.
The army, the only Yugoslav federal body that is still functioning, is putting pressure on the leadership not to adjourn the session and is demanding a yes or no answer to its request to impose a state of emergency. The army has made clear that if no decision is reached, it will no longer consider the presidency its supreme command. The crisis between rival Croatians and Serbs exploded last week and has claimed 18 lives in brutal attacks. Several incidents have involved the Serb-dominated army, which Croatians consider an occupying force. Today, the Deputy Defense Minister, Admiral Stane Bobet, warned in Parliament that the army would use force against any extremists who incite ethnic violence. With the presidency paralyzed, there is mounting feeling here that the army could soon decide to act on its own. In Belgrade, this is Sylvia Pajoli.
The Dow Jones Industrials moved up 13 points. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House Armed Services Committee has reportedly voted for large cuts in the president's military budget for the so-called Star Wars plan and B-2 stealth bomber. Congressional sources say the panel followed the action of its Research and Development Subcommittee, which yesterday cut the Bush administration's request of $5.2 billion to about $3.6 billion. South African President F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela met today in a last-ditch effort to resolve a deadlock between them over continuing township violence. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The deadline set by the African National Congress for the cutoff of talks about a new constitution expires at midnight tonight. Mandela has demanded that the president take more forceful steps to stop the violence. De Klerk and Mandela met in Pretoria today for several hours in strict secrecy. No statement was issued by either side afterwards, but reports said that de Klerk wants to consult the cabinet and Mandela wants to talk to his executive before there's a public statement. There were no indications of whether the meeting went well or badly. But while they were meeting, Law and Order Minister Adrian Flock announced new measures to curb the violence, measures that are likely to prove controversial. He banned all public gatherings in the areas torn by violence and promised to step up the police and military presence there and tighten the nighttime curfew. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
A federal court jury in Detroit has found Northwest Airlines fully to blame for a 1987 crash that killed 156 people. The jury found that Northwest should bear 100% of the responsibility for the crash and that it was the flight crew's negligence that contributed to the accident. The jury also said that the airline was negligent in its training and supervision of the airline crew. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The music you're hearing is by my guest Thomas Mafumo. This song and his new album are both titled Chaminora, which translates to "What Are We Fighting For?" Thomas Mafumo is called the Lion of Zimbabwe, and he's been fighting with words and music for almost 20 years. His politically ferocious songs have been called the soundtrack for the revolution that in 1980 brought black majority rule to what was then Rhodesia. Mafumo grew up in a rural village at the home of his grandparents, exposed to the traditional spiritual and musical worlds. He moved to the city when he was 10. His music wasn't always political. He started off singing a mix of pop and rock songs from Europe and America, as well as Africa. In the 70s, he began to think that his culture was being lost in the mix. He formed a band that combined African instruments like the thumb piano with electric guitars. He sings in Shona, the language spoken by 70% of Zimbabweans. Mafumo says that even though the revolution is over, the lyrics of his songs haven't changed much.
Long time ago, before Zimbabwe became independent, we were singing about our own freedom. And now that we are independent and we've got our freedom, we are, focusing our music, on worldwide. We are actually singing about the plight of the people in the rest of the world, people sleeping in the streets, people who have no jobs, and people who have nowhere to go.
Let me play one of the political songs that you recorded, and then we'll talk more about your music. And this is a song that translates to, "Who shall we share our frustrations with?" Would you say something about this song before we hear it, when it was recorded, what it's about?
This song was written during the liberation struggle. And it was one of our instant hits. When we recorded this tune, that's the time when our people were being harassed by the police, the soldiers, and some of them running from the rural areas to come to live into town trying to find some shelter. And, that made me to write this song because we had no one to turn to. We were just, a people who were just fighting, for their freedom. And we were not protected at all.
And what year did you record this, do you remember?
I believe it was recorded in 77, it must be 78. What a passage, you got a mapo.
This Thomas Mafumo, one of the records that's been collected on a new album called the Chimurenga Singles, 1976 to 1980. No, I believe the record that we just heard was banned from the radio in what was then Rhodesia.
At first, they never knew what was going on.
Because they didn't understand the lyrics.
They didn't understand the lyrics. They played it on the radio, and so that, I mean, they gave it, I mean, a good advert. And people knew about this record. And when they banned it, it was too late to stop, I mean, people from buying the record. They all went out to the record shops asking for it.
You were arrested for 90 days because of your music. You were in jail for 90 days. What were you charged with? Were you charged with anything?
Well, they only said that the music was political and subversive and that it was influencing a lot of young people to get out of the country, be trained, get a gun, come back, fighting the government of that day.
What was that time like for you, those 90 days in prison?
Well, very frightening anyway, because you wouldn't know what was going to happen to you next. Maybe you were going to disappear, or maybe you were just going to be killed, and your people wouldn't know what would have happened.
Did you feel protected by your fame? People knew who you were.
Yes, yes. I felt very much protected by that.
Did the guards there know your music?
Yes, they knew my music and they were very friendly to me. And a lot of them were. They used to come to my cell and we used to sit down and talk.
Were the guards white or black?
They were white.
And they knew your music and
liked
it?
They knew my music, yes.
I want to play something else from your new record. And this is a song called Murambadoro.
Murambadoro, that's right.
Tell us something about this song.
Song Murambadoro. Murambadoro means one who doesn't want to drink. But, I mean, the meaning is that we are not talking about people who don't want to drink beer. The Murambadoro is one who doesn't want to involve himself in dirty things like corruption or killing people because maybe you want power, and all that has to do with corruption. That is the meaning of that song, Murambadoro. Agomana Murambadoro. Agomana Murambadoro. Agomana Guaya Pera. Agomana Dude Guiena.
That's Murambadoro from Thomas Mafumo's new album. It must be interesting to you that when you come to the United States, for instance, I'll bet a lot of your audiences are predominantly white in American cities, because it seems like a lot of the world music audience is a white audience in the United States.
Okay.
I'm just guessing here, but I mean, tell me what your experiences are with that and how it strikes you.
Yeah, it's been a surprise to me, because we have seen a lot of our audiences being white and very few black people. I don't know what that means, because we are supposed to be seeing our people coming to to these gigs are on black people coming to listen to it, because we are from Africa. And that's where, that's where slaves came from. They came from Africa, coming to America. They were brought to America. And they are Africans, just like me, though they don't speak Shona or they don't speak any other, real African languages. But they are Africans. Can they forget their roots? They are not supposed to forget their roots. They are supposed to be with us. When we come here, they are supposed to, to be the first people to come and meet us, rather than being met by our white friends. And, well, this, to me, it disturbs me a lot.
See, you're disappointed.
I am very much disappointed about that.
Well, I think African music doesn't really get played on commercial stations, radio stations.
Well,
in other words, I think a lot of African Americans don't ever get to hear it.
When we do a gig, this gig is supposed to be, to have been advertised. So when they see that this man is from Africa, he's coming to America, they got to know that, this is their own brother, and the music he's bringing to America is their own culture.
My guest is Thomas Mafumo. He's one of the most popular performers in Zimbabwe and one of the best-known figures in world music. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Singer Thomas Mafumo of Zimbabwe is my guest. Now, I know that you started off playing in nightclubs before your music became more political. What kind of music were you playing when you started performing?
Well, I was actually playing all kinds of music. As you know, in a club, we were a band, which was actually playing a lot of copyright music, foreign type of music, like Western style, music from South Africa, music from Zaire, and music from England. Well, we played all that type of music.
What kind of music were you playing from America?
Well, rock and roll. We played rock and roll music. We played soul music. We also played what they call funk jazz. We played that type of music, and we also played jazz music.
Tell me about how, when you were growing up, the role that music played in your life. When you were young, before you moved to the city.
When I was growing up, I thought music was for entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, I used to go and listen to other groups play, and I listened to a lot of different types of music, as I've told you. We had African groups who were playing what they call African jazz. We used to fill up the halls to go and listen to these people. They were imitating some of the American groups like Crew Cuts, Mills Brothers, and the rest of them who were into the jazz world. So we went to listen to these people. They were actually imitating. It wasn't their own style.
When you started performing, were there things that you would do to imitate, in the way you dressed or the way, even in the way that you sang?
Yeah, yes.
What kinds of things?
Well, suppose I'm doing an Otis Redding song.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I got to imitate, the ways that Otis Redding was doing on the stage. And if maybe I'm doing a Frank Sinatra jazz song, I have to dress like a jazz musician. I put on my dinner suit and my bow tie. I go up on the stage and start singing. And when I'm actually doing the other type of music, like rock and roll, You know, a lot of, I mean, youngsters who were involved in rock and roll, where they used to dress, I mean, in a fancy way. You have to have much hair.
Now, if you don't mind my mentioning it, the way you're dressed, you could be an American rock or funk star now. You have a big black kind of cap on. You have a jacket. I'm not very good at describing clothes, but you're wearing a kind of like sweatsuit and a really stylish jacket over it. It almost looks like a bomber jacket, except it's made out of fabric and not leather.
That's right.
So it seems, I mean, you're hardly wearing traditional African garb. You know what I mean? You could definitely be an American rock star the way you're dressed.
Well, when it comes to dressing, I don't think that matters at all. It might matter when it comes to be on the stage. When I'm actually doing my own roots music, I have to dress the way I think this is the right way I must present myself, because I'll be actually trying to show the American people how we dress back at home when I am in that mood.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what it's like to perform your music, which is very political, very much rooted in your culture, and to perform it like right now on a tour in the United States, where most of your listeners won't understand the lyrics unless you give them an English translation for it beforehand. And, you know, you're performing in clubs and performance halls really outside of a political context. So is that a comfortable situation for you? Do you enjoy that?
I enjoy that very much. I enjoy meeting, you know, meeting a lot of different people, and also seeing them, I mean, dancing to my music.
Do people always know how to dance to your music, because they're not necessarily used to dancing to African music?
Oh, yes. Most of them are, you know, just good dancers,
right?
Better than some of our African people back home.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thomas Mafumo's new album, Chiminorwa, is on the Mango label. He's currently on the American part of a world tour. He performs in New York tonight, in Boston May 10th, and on Mountain Stage in Charleston, West Virginia on May 12th. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the CIA director's resignation?
Well, apparently he is retiring, Terry, and the president has accepted his decision to resign but has not yet said who he's going to want in that slot. Nina Totenberg will have more on it. The gun control bill, the waiting period, the Brady bill, is moving through the House. We will have both a story and, we think, a song on that. Bangladesh, we have somebody in from the World Bank to talk about what the bank is trying to do to rebuild that country, and a story on hidden children, Jewish children hidden away during World War II, and what effect that's had on their lives.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week on Fresh Air, while I was on vacation, Frank Browning interviewed journalist Gloria Emerson about her new book on the Gaza Strip. Today, book critic John Leonard has his review of Gaza.
The next time you need to think about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the intifada of the Palestinians, there's a new book on the small shelf of the literature of shame. To David Grossman's The Yellow Wind, Felicia Langer's An Age of Stone, and Yoram Binur's My Enemy, Myself, add Gloria Emerson's Gaza. At first, it seems that Emerson's tongue-tied, or at least stammering through clenched jaw and grinding teeth, indifferent to niceties of grammar and syntax, jumbled like the Palestinians in their wretched prisons and equally wretched refugee camps. She has reported on four wars, mostly for the New York Times. Vietnam turned her into a ghost at the Third World Banquet. What she sees in Gaza, between sand dunes and cactus hedge, under the orange trees, in a pewter-colored light, seems almost to have rendered speech her enemy. She spent a year, 1989, in this occupied territory. It's not even the favorite occupied territory for visiting journalists. It isn't at all biblical or even historical, except to the dispossessed. but almost three times as many children are injured and killed each year in Gaza as on the West Bank. From her post at Marna House, where at night they watch video cassettes of English and European TV documentaries on the Intifada to remind themselves of the faces of those who have since been jailed or shot, Emerson ventures forth to hospitals, camps, and prisons, to courts and clinics and the Baptist nursing school. She tries to let the Palestinians do her talking for her. They talk about stone throwing, met with sniper fire and broken collarbones, about steel and plastic bullets, expanding dum-dums and high-velocity M16s, about detention and torture without charge or bail, about the demolishing of houses of families of suspects who've yet to be brought to trial, about deportations, and on the doctor's certificate, this explanation, blunt trauma to the abdomen, which really means the prisoner was kicked to death. She listens to doctors, lawyers, teachers, even communists and Islamic fundamentalists. These Palestinians aren't permitted their flag or their national anthem, aren't allowed to meet in groups of more than five without official Israeli permission. When they get too flowery in their Arabic, when, for instance, a man with two sons in prison says, "Heaven has a red-colored gate that can only be opened with bloody hands," Emerson will switch to a language of statistics. She'll crunch the awful numbers of the UN observers and the Human Rights Watchdog Committees and the State Department policy advisors and all the important news organizations. She will also describe the nail-studded clubs used by the soldiers, like baseball bats with black tape to improve the grip, and the black hoods strung over the heads of the naked prisoners, smelling of sweat and vomit, and the tear gas canisters hanging from the telephone wires, like lunatic mobiles. Finally, Emerson brings herself to analogize Northern Ireland and South Africa. It was a discouraging time, she says, for those Israelis who, in the words of Camus, wanted to love their country and love justice. This is speech not after long silence, but after awkward rage. It seems to me that she has assembled her words like stones and then thrown them, as the dispossessed have been throwing stones at soldiers and prophets and the eye of God forever in the holy desert.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Gaza by Gloria Emerson. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Dorothy Farabee, our administrative assistant. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The writers' organization PEN just gave their Ernest Hemingway Award to Bernard Cooper. We'll meet him on the next Fresh Air. Also, Naomi Wolf on how women are tyrannized by pressures to make themselves beautiful. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.